coming up on Path to Zero.
We are reinventing geothermal energy to make it the cleanest, most scalable, reliable, and affordable energy, hopefully, in the world at some point.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Welcome to Path to Zero. You've tuned in for what I expect to be a fascinating episode because we're exploring one of the most exciting frontiers in clean energy, next generation geothermal. Our guest is Sarah Jewett, Vice President of Strategy at Fervo Energy. The company is reinventing geothermal using the same advanced drilling techniques that transformed the U.S. oil and gas industry. Fervo's first commercial project in Nevada proved the model works, and now the team is building Cape Station in Utah, a 500-megawatt development that's drawn national attention, including a recent visit from Bill Gates. Sarah, it is great to have you on Path to Zero. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tucker, for having me.
So looking forward to having a long talk about geothermal, but let's start with the most obvious. Tell us about Fervo, what they do, what you do there, and maybe even what you're proud of and excited about.
Man, okay, I could just talk for the next 60 minutes about what Fervo does, what I do, and what I'm
doing. Yeah, I was going to say, and try to do it in 5 minutes if you can.
I got you. So a little bit about what Fervo is doing is we are reinventing geothermal energy to make it the cleanest, most scalable, reliable, and affordable energy, hopefully, in the world at some point. So we were started in 2017, and the idea is that geothermal, though it's been around for a long time, can be way more powerful than it is if we are able to scale it in a little bit more of a predictable and reliable fashion. It's not a new technology whatsoever, but we are taking a bit of a different approach to subsurface heat extraction. I'm sure we'll get into that. So I'll just leave it at that and leave us on a cliffhanger for now. New approach to subsurface heat extraction, pretty traditional approach to power generation on the surface. And yes, we're trying to build geothermal into a very, very big part of our energy mix.
If we go back to 2015, maybe even 2018, 19, geothermal was pretty limited to residential technologies and maybe one or two commercial scales. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the geysers has been around and producing utility scale electricity since the 1960s. So it's actually more embedded in our energy mix than most people know about, but it still only makes up about 0.5% of the U.S. energy mix.
0.5%. Where, interesting, Finland would be, I mean, some of those countries are way high, right? 50, 60, 70%?
Yeah, Iceland is really the leading country for geothermal power, and it's over 60% there also. Kenya has over 60% of their electricity comes from geothermal power.
So let's talk about what y'all are doing differently. And I think anybody who studied your resume would know that you kind of came from Schlumberger, and certainly Fervo is applying a lot of technology that we learned in the oil patch around directional drilling to now this technology, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in my intro, I broke it down into subsurface heat extraction and on-surface power generation. So I'll talk about those two things because sometimes it helps people wrap their mind around what we're doing. We are really innovating on the subsurface heat extraction side of the equation. Traditionally, geothermal has been pretty geographically constrained to areas that have basically what you think of as hot springs. Large underground, highly natural fractured networks, often laden with steam, and you can either stick a vertical well into the ground and pull steam out directly for power generation, or drill a pair of wells and then use the natural fracture system to help heat up water between them. This is geographically constrained because you have to go find those very specific types of resources, and they're hard to find, and even when you find them, sometimes you'll drill a well and you'll sort of miss the natural fracture system altogether. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to de-risk that. There's hot rock everywhere in the world, and it's just a question of leveraging our ability to create what is now a subsurface radiator and pull heat out of hot rock anywhere. We're applying proven technologies from the oil and gas industry, like horizontal drilling, multi-stage completion, fiber optic monitoring, things that are really run-of-the-mill in the oil and gas industry to create these subsurface radiators that are very predictable and scalable ways to extract heat from the earth.
And you started, I think, in Nevada. You are now the project in Utah. But I know you talk about it's geographically could be well dispersed, but is there any part of the U.S. that you are really excited about?
Yeah, so I mentioned in my last answer that there's heat everywhere. It's just a question of how you can extract it. And why we've started in the Western United States is because there is very significant heat near the surface of the earth. So you don't have to drill. Well, to humans, it's pretty deep. We're drilling to about 8,500 feet deep, which blows a lot of people's minds. That's a mile and a half into the ground. But when you think about the oil and gas context where we've been drilling well 7,000, 10,000, 12,000 feet deep for the last 25 years or more, actually, it's not that deep. So we are trying to leverage very high temperatures, which is 200 degrees C or hotter, at very shallow depths in the Western United States. And the reason why we would start in the West is because it's found at 200 degrees C is found at shallower depths. If you go east to, say, Pennsylvania or West Virginia, of course, you can find 200 degrees C temperature, but it's much, much deeper. So it's more expensive to drill. So what we're trying to do is start in the West, where the resource is easily accessible, make geothermal economically viable there, and then we can open up the geographic aperture beyond the Western United States.
That's really exciting. All right, well, let's talk about Project Red, right? Project Red in Nevada. Tell us about that project and maybe how lessons learned there led you to Cape Station.
Yeah, so Project Red, for listeners, was our combined commercial and technological pilot. What does that mean? We were proving our technology at the same time that we wanted to prove that there was a buyer who had a willingness to pay a premium for firm clean energy. So clean energy that was not dependent on the weather and produced around the clock power. And we decided to do that, to make a technological pilot wrapped in a commercial pilot, because we thought the market's going to shift here. And we were big believers that firm clean energy was going to develop, you know, a reputation for a very, very valuable resource. And we didn't think that we had time necessarily to go prove our tech and then build something that was commercial. So at Project Red, what we did was we located on the outskirts of a field where there was already an existing power plant. So CERC Energy owned the power facility. They had already drilled hydrothermal, traditional geothermal wells there, and they were already producing geothermal power. We said, hey, we want to step out of your traditional resource, and we want to develop our own subsurface system at no cost to you. And in the event that we produce hot brine, we would love for you to take it and pay us for it. And so that is sort of the arrangement that we contracted at Project Red, was really power uplift to an existing power facility.
And what scale power are we talking about here? Are we talking about 20 megawatts? What are we talking about?
It was pretty small as far as geothermal, well, Fervo's geothermal systems go now. It's a three-well system. We call it a two-well system because there were two horizontal wells. One was an injection well, one was a production well. The laterals were 3,500 feet long, so shorter than what we're drilling today. And then we had a vertical monitoring well that we put a lot of tools and jewelry in to sort of monitor the system. So that project overall produces about 3 megawatts of power on a net basis.
Which is great power. I mean, it's 3 megawatts that didn't exist until you went there. All right, so now let's talk about how you leveraged what you've learned to go to Cape Station in Utah. Let's talk about that project.
Excellent. Project Red was really meant to signify kind of like a Fervo injector producer unit. And we decided that if it worked, then when we went to build a greenfield power development at which we would lease the land rather than stepping out from an existing power facility. We would lease the land, do the entire well field development, build the power facility, build the transmission and distribution line to a main line, and actually sell the power commercially. So that's how we define the difference between Project Red and a greenfield development. The idea was take what we learned at Project Red, pairing these two wells together, and go deploy it sort of over and over and over again in a repeated way so that we can bring down the cost of our drilling through very continuous learnings. Cape Station today, it's in Southwest Utah, in Beaver County, Utah. It is currently planned as a 500 megawatt two-phase project. What does that mean? We are delivering 100 megawatts to the grid in 2026 and an additional 400 megawatts to the grid in 2028. And we have done what we set out to do. We have three well pads and we have drilled wells over and over again. So we've now completed the entire well field for phase one, drilling 24 wells and bringing down the cost of drilling really significantly since Project Red.
Really, really interesting. So when you go to permit this or build it, let's talk about the three groups you need to sell it to. One, you need to sell it to the locals for land use policy issues. You need to sell it to your customers and you need to sell it to your investors. What are the pros and cons that you talk about to each of those groups?
Yeah, so I'm very much personally responsible for selling the projects to the communities where we operate. I'll talk about that group first, also since you listed it first. I think the positives for Beaver County and the Milford, Utah community are pretty straightforward. You know, we came in at a time when one of their largest non-ag employers was laying off a bunch of people. And when we said, we're going to build a big project here, the biggest question we get is, when are you going to start hiring people? So for a community that's very, very small, that's focused on jobs are really the main thing that you can provide. We really provide jobs in a number of different ways. Direct hiring, so hiring people to actually come work for Fervo. At this time, we have about 20 people in the local community who are Fervo full-time employees who've been hired to actually service this plant. You can encourage locals to hire on with all of your contractors. So we have 350 people on site right now doing contract and construction work across a variety of different companies. So you can encourage a local funnel from, you know, your local community into those companies. And you as a company can help facilitate that. We can help facilitate hiring events. We can facilitate training, those types of things. And then number three is we can use just local contractors to actually work on the site. So we have been very tightly connected with groups like Rollins Construction, that's headquartered in Beaver County, does all of our dirt work for us for Project Cape. Vortex Crane, headquartered in Milford, Utah, does a lot of our crane work. So we try to use local vendors wherever we can. So jobs is a big one. Still, you have to build trust and say, not only are we going to provide you with jobs, but we're going to provide you with a very sustainable project that you will actually, you know, welcome into your community that will create positive economic development here, but not positive economic development at the expense of anything else. And so we have tried over the years to be very, very closely connected with what the community wants and needs from an economic development perspective and ensure that we can deliver on that. So I've talked long enough, but that was really an answer about selling this project to local stakeholders. I'm happy to answer further questions about
that. That's great. And
to the other groups.
Well, it's good. I mean, if somebody was drilling a gas well in these communities, there'd be a lot of concern around the impacts of hydraulic fracturing, right? Perhaps increased seismic activity, a little bit of concern about contamination of groundwater. Do you have those same concerns when you enter? Or let me say it differently. Do the residents express those same concerns?
I would say we have answered questions about concerns from every different angle of the project. And any risk, such as the ones you said, induced seismicity, water usage, groundwater contamination, a big one is truck traffic through town up a tiny main street, those types of things. You have to take them all incredibly seriously. And we do take them incredibly seriously as a company, work very, very proactively to mitigate any harm, environmental or otherwise, that we could cause for the community, and then be very open and honest and transparent about what the risks are, what we're doing to mitigate or prevent those risks. And then, you know, in the event that anything bad does happen, what you're doing in order to remediate the situation. So sure, I mean, when you're building a large infrastructure project in a rural community, there were always concerns. But for the most part, I think we've created the venues, the trust and the transparency such that the community trusts that when we say something, we actually mean it and we take it seriously.
Well, and so most of those concerns you're talking about really are around construction. Once that facility is built, I mean, I think of them as relatively quiet. I mean, there is machinery, you are producing power, but generally these are relatively smaller scale. And as you say, into communities that probably would accept that for the jobs. Is there any general pushback?
From an operations perspective?
Environmentally focused. I don't want you drilling on my lands because.
Yeah, you know, we have not gotten that pushback very much. And I think, you know, there's plenty of NIMBYism out there, and some of it is very well deserved and some of it is overblown. I started my career fracking in oil and gas, and I actually thought a lot of the fear and concerns around oil and gas fracking were a bit overblown and, you know, due to lack of education about what the process actually was. That said, you know, one of the biggest selling points for geothermal is, yes, the plants are quiet. We're not using any actual steam in our power generation cycle. We are using brine that goes to a heat exchanger. All the heat gets stripped out of the geothermal brine, transferred to a working fluid. The working fluid goes through power gen and is cooled, but it all remains contained. So there's no actual steam plumes like you would expect from a geothermal facility. So visually, it's pretty minimal. From a noise and sound, from a sound perspective, it's pretty minimal. And then these projects have no emissions associated with them once they're operating. So I think, you know, generally, once the projects are operating, they're pretty innocuous.
Worried about water contamination or anything to do? I mean, you know, in hydraulic fracturing of oil and gas, there's a lot of talk now about the water consumed, the wastewater. I mean, it's become as big as the business of producing oil and gas itself. Any concerns around that?
So water consumption is typically a bigger concern in the high mountain west desert, where, you know, the other big water consumption activity is agriculture and livestock. That's a bigger concern than water contamination. The fluids that we are pumping into our resources are pretty chemically benign. And that is because in oil and gas, a lot of the chemicals that are put into frac fluids are intended to control the oil-water interface. There's no oil in these reservoirs, so that's just not something that we have to contend with. Similarly, because some of the biggest complaints with fracking are the methane that's pulled out of the wells, and there's no, you know, there's no hydrocarbons in these wells, so it really simplifies things for us.
We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, more with Fervo Energy's Sarah Jewett.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com. Maybe I'll win.
Welcome back to Path to Zero. We're here with Sarah Jewett from Fervo Energy talking about the future of geothermal power. As you think about this technology and kind of scale it compared to other power generating technologies, obviously not any comparison to coal or oil, much faster to market right now probably than nuclear, right? The only downside is ability to scale, right?
I would say that nuclear is also having a bit of a downside, which is, you know, the inability to scale. They get a reputation for being very scalable.
Right. But so far, huge concerns around safety, huge concerns around fuel, where you have none of that, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why we have, you know, received so much positive attention and support recently, is we have been able to drill and construct power facilities in a very, very rapid fashion out in Southwest Utah. And this is just Fervo's first project. We have areas of interest where we already have leased the acreage and done initial geotechnical work, some commercial work all over the American West. And so we have the ability to scale very rapidly beyond Cape Station once we prove that Cape Station works. The one thing that I would say that, you know, you just made an assumption, Tucker, that we don't compare ourselves to traditional hydrocarbon resources. I think, you know, initially when I started at Fervo, we were very much comparing ourselves to other clean technologies, saying this is a higher capacity factor resource that may be more expensive than other clean technologies, but it produces around the clock. With supply chain constraints and constraints in natural gas supply at this point in time, we are now seeing a world where we're contending much more regularly just for, as a baseload power resource from an affordability and scalability perspective than we ever thought was possible.
Yeah. What's the one downside when somebody goes, I don't want that because, what's the one downside that makes you cringe? Anything?
Honestly, we have not had that much, I don't want that because. I think from an environmental perspective, we have, you know, the benefit of producing a higher power output per unit of land disturbed. We are putting, you know, we're putting 10 horizontal wells on a single 6-acre pad that are going to potentially produce between them 50 megawatts of power. And if you try to replicate that with a solar project or solar plus storage, the amount of surface disturbance you're executing is much higher. You know, water consumption is a concern, but it is more controlled by keeping brine in a closed loop in the subsurface and not actually using it to vent to atmosphere for power generation. We're also, you know, using air cooling on all of our plants rather than water cooling to ensure we minimize water usage in our plants. Seismicity is the other big concern that we're very consistently working to mitigate and also address from a community concerns perspective. But so far, we've been operating now for, let's see, a total of two years and constructing for longer than that. And we have proven to effectively mitigate seismicity in construction. So I think, you know, so far we are a pretty likable resource.
Yeah, I think probably,
yeah. I think there's a pretty keen eye trained on our costs right now. We have historically been considered a very high cost resource. And a lot of that is we're seeking this specific resource. Wells don't always work. We are rapidly bringing down the cost of geothermal power to ensure that it is widely affordable.
So let's talk about that for a second, because again, the parallel between you and the oil and gas industry, particularly in terms of technology, using technology, you see a lot of parallels. And let's think about it, you know, what we're doing, you know, in the Permian, the Bakken, those shale plays. I mean, we're doing something now that I don't even think Harold Hamm, who invented it, right? I don't think he had any idea of what this would become. Do you see some technology shifts or some scale shifts that might make this look like the Permian looked 25 years ago. You see technology changing that all of a sudden makes the costs here wildly competitive?
Yeah, I mean, what we have seen happen in the United States over the last 25 years in shale will ultimately be hugely beneficial to the proliferation of geothermal energy. When I think we showed up on the scene, we were like the first geothermal company in the United States to use a modern HMP flex rig in a geothermal field before. It's just not something that was done. We are the first people to drill a 5,000 foot horizontal lateral in a granitic basement, because a lot of people said, you know, you can't drill horizontally in geothermal or in granitic basements. You can't frack in the types of rock that, you know, are good for geothermal power development. So there was a lot of self-imposed limitations on what we thought our existing technology could do, that the oil and gas industry, meanwhile, is innovating for a completely different application, while geothermal is kind of stalling in its own application. And then what we have done is we've basically lifted this incredibly powerful, scientific, physics-driven suite of innovation tools and tech, and we've applied it in geothermal energy, and it has just totally unlocked the potential for this resource that is not that scientifically different than what we have been doing for the last 25 years in the Permian and the Bakken.
And ready now, right? These, to your point earlier, shovel-ready solutions are pretty interesting right now when there aren't a lot of solutions.
Yeah, that's
right. You know, you don't read a lot about incentives. You read a lot about incentives for solar and wind and whether they've come and gone and other incentives. Don't read a lot about geothermal incentives. Do you feel like you get adequate support from governments, and maybe not even just the U.S. government, but governments around the world? Is geothermal appropriately supported?
I think the answer to that is probably yes and no. There is more persistent, consistent support across governments in the world for geothermal now than there was when I started working for Fervo in 2020, or when Tim and Jack started the business in 2017. They started the business with the assumption that we would not necessarily have geothermal tax credits to lean on when we built our projects, because there was a 10% investment tax credit that was instituted in about 2006 for geothermal that did not sunset. And so we had that 10% ITC. And then there was sometimes a reasonable production tax credit, a PTC, but it would sort of like expire and lapse, and then it would come back and then it would expire again. And the first time, Tim Latimer tells this hilarious story that the first time he went to Washington, he knocked on a few doors in Congress and asked about the geothermal PTC and said, like, why did the geothermal PTC lapse? Why was it not extended when everyone else's tax credits were extended? And the answer was kind of like, oh, nobody's ever asked us that question before. And so I
think nobody ever asked.
It's a small industry that no one ever thinks about. And so, you know, when we really started working on the economics of these projects, we typically fixated on the fact that we are on uneven playing field with, say, wind and solar. And so we're being compared to them on an LCOE basis, but we do not benefit from similar tax incentives. The IRA changed that, actually, and it brought geothermal energy up to being on a level playing field with solar. That was a really big deal for us and definitely gave us the ability to build bigger and better projects. And then obviously, you know, there was a pretty reasonable fight for tax credits in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And we managed to preserve geothermal tax credits for the next about decade before they phase out. We're big believers that tax credits could and should phase out over time once technologies sort of get their feet under them. And so that is what we intend to do, is prove that this technology can come down a meaningful cost curve over the next 5 to 10 years so that it doesn't need the federal support.
Well, if you don't get a lot of incentives, you need a lot of investors. And you've had some pretty interesting looks from investors. I mean, Bill Gates talks about geothermal quite a bit. But what do some of these leading clean tech groups, when they come look at Fervo? What do they say? Sign me up.
Yes, that is what they say. It's that easy. I mean, we have a very productive track record of consistent fundraising. And I think what we have done with the investor community, which I always tell new entrepreneurs about when they're asking about fundraising and what is the key to Fervo's fundraising success, is that we have laid out a very, you know, achievable but challenging set of technical milestones that we must achieve. And then we have managed to those expectations. So we fundraise on these milestones, and then we take the money that we fundraise and we go achieve them. And then we show our investors that we did what we said we were going to do with the money that we said we were going to do it with. And so I think when you do that over and over and over again, and you develop this track record of when we say we're going to raise, you know, $28 million in our Series B, or $100 million or $350 million, and we say what we're going to go do with those funds, and then we go do it, it creates a really believable story where investors say, when Fervo says that they're going to go do something, we know that they're going to go do it. And so we are going to continue to invest round over round. I was going to say year over year, and I was like, that's not year, but really our rounds have been in subsequent years. So yes, year over year.
It's interesting. Yeah. So and we've seen Bill Gates talk a lot about it. Said at the beginning, you said about one half of 1%. That's where geothermal is in the U.S. Where do you, in a dream world, where do you see it going? Do you see it being able to be 3-4%? Energy mix?
We are big believers at Fervo, and we are drinking our own Kool-Aid, but we're big believers that we will see geothermal supply over 20% of the U.S. power grid by 2050.
So that would equate to about the same size as the nuclear energy industry today.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's really the other thing that investors get excited about when they learn about Fervo's story, is nuclear has been very front of mind for everyone, that we need this power, we need baseload clean energy, and they've been fixated on this is kind of the one solution. So when people find Fervo and they find geothermal and they're educated that it is not, we say, not your grandma's geothermal, it's something new, different, scalable, applying proven technology from another very large, very American industry, the shale industry, to create a really meaningful impact with clean energy, it's a very compelling and exciting story for a lot of investors. So I think, this is not something with small stakes. It's something with big stakes on the table.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's good. All right. We love to have a little bit of fun, Sarah. We're going to ask you a question. And over the years, it's kind of become the highlight for me of the podcast. And I'm going to hand you a magic wand. And with that power, you get to choose one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact on, I would say, clean climate, power demand. You can kind of pick, but it's in your wheelhouse. I handed you the wand. How would you use it?
Oh, this is so fun. Low cost capital. That's not the sexiest answer, but I think it's my first, second, and third answer to that question is, the more we can convince lower cost of capital investors that this business is real and the risk is lower than they perceive it to be, the more willing low cost capital will be, and the more that we can build projects with the capital that we do actually have. So,
interesting. Yeah. One of the more boring answers, but in fact, probably one of the more truthful answers. So let's follow up on that though. Because if you think about this, where is the risk, right? Generally, your output can be anchored by long-term contracts that probably are rising in value rather than falling in value. What's the risk in a geothermal investor?
Yeah, I think people are really anchored to traditional geothermal energy that suffered from a couple of different angles. One, I sort of talked about this natural fracture system that we're trying to hit in traditional geothermal to convey our fluid from injection well to production well and heat it up. It's not something that we create. It's not something that we control. It's not necessarily something that we have characterized. And so when we go to drill our vertical wells into it, we might miss the natural fracture system entirely, creating what is traditionally referred to as dry wells. And the track record for the historic geothermal industry on dry wells is not great. Basically, like a third of the wells that were drilled in geothermal were dry. And so when like we look at our well costs as a significant portion of our overall CapEx, if one in three of those was just basically we're lighting the capital on fire, we would have way higher cost projects that would be way less predictable. So dry hole risk has been something that's plagued the industry for a long time. And then the other reason why geothermal is perceived to be high risk is these traditional projects. You know, because they're sort of accessing this natural resource, there weren't necessarily ways that in the event that they started to lose temperature in that resource, or they started to sort of drain the resource of steam or temperature or whatever the system relied upon, that they could increase the power uplift at their existing facility. So their power plant's still good, still has life on it, but the brine or the steam that is fueling that power plant is just declining, and there's kind of like nothing they can do about it. And so, you know, Fervo has eliminated the risk on both of these fronts. One, we're drilling these horizontal wells that all access the same rock. And so we're not looking for this specific thing in the subsurface. So that eliminates dry hole risk. And then we've eliminated the binary nature of, you know, this a certain amount of power input, because if we start losing temperature in our system, we can just go drill another well pair and increase the power output. But I think investors are a little bit slow to the table thinking that we could actually have turned these two issues that have plagued the geothermal energy industry around. So there's a little bit of like, we want to see the plants operate for a while. We want to watch it work. We want to understand the power decline, how many wells Fervo has to drill after commercial online date. And so there's a little bit of wait and see on that front.
Well, interesting. You just think about, again, where AI is going to change things, and we kind of can see it now, seismology and predicting where is the right spot to drill. It's come a long ways, and I suspect it's going to go a lot further before they quit. So we'll give you that. A good use of the magic wand, lower access to lower cost of capital. That's harsh to call it boring. I think it's probably... It's pretty accurate. All right, last piece.
I'm making our CFO proud. He would be very proud.
That's true. Last thing we love to do is we love to plant a tree in honor of your time, out of respect for all you're doing and sharing that expertise with us. We love it to be a national forest, and you get to pick the place.
Oh, wow.
Where is a national forest that you would love to have a tree planted in your name?
I would say National Forest outside of Pinedale, Wyoming, where I started my career fracking in the Jonah Field. And I have spent many, many, many hours recreating in the National Forest, North Pinedale. And that is really where I would love for it.
That is where it will be then. That's a great spot, a beautiful spot, and a place we'd be honored to remind everybody of this particular conversation. All right, before we let you go, anything else you want us to tell about you, about Fervo, maybe how to learn more, how to follow your success, maybe how to be a source of that low risk capital?
Oh, yeah. Well, we, you know, are growing our online presence. You can follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook or your, you know, platform of choosing. I would say be a fan of geothermal. Tell people that you talk to about energy, about geothermal, this little known energy that's becoming a bigger and bigger part of our, you know, national energy security landscape.
It's awesome. Sarah, thanks so much for telling us the story of Fervo and for what you're doing for what I would call true clean tech. And thanks for being with us on Path to Zero.
Thank you so much, Tucker.
That does it for this episode of Path to Zero. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app and check out the full library of episodes on YouTube and Substack. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.